and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, as the year ends today, we'll discuss the biggest economic stories of 2018 and the big picture on our weekly series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Also, we're looking at the year in review in our regular segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Today, we look at the changes and developments in the world of technology over the past year. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the U.S. economy. As 2018 ends today, we'll discuss the biggest economic stories of the year and the big picture on our weekly series called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We are joined from the Bay Area by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What's a dead cat bouncing?
A dead cat bounce is a little bit of what we're probably seeing in the markets lately. Basically, it's a term that was coined on Wall Street, and it means that if a cat were to die and fall out of a building, it would be dead, it would hit the ground, it would bounce momentarily as it hit the ground, right? There would be an upward swing as it bounced on the ground, only, of course, to come back down because the animal is dead. And so brokers often use this to refer to when the market is plunging, there will be a temporary lift in it as a certain amount of investors say to themselves, you know, I bet it's going to come back up. And right now I'm going to buy at rock bottom prices. You know, I'm going to buy low, sell high. And so they buy on the dead cat bounce. But the problem is it's a dead cat. It's not going to bounce up. It's going to come back down inevitably, and they're going to end up losing more. And I think that's kind of what we saw. You know, we saw the stock market just a few days ago shoot up 1,000 points, which is some kind of record, only to likely see it tumble back down again the day after several hundred points. So that's kind of the dead cat bounce that they're referring to.
Nicole Russell, the producer of this show, was really upset when she learned the expression about dead cat bouncing because she cares about cats, which we all do. But I think it's an apropos phrase because what we have, Daniel, is we're bouncing off of headlines too. If you look at the big picture of the stock market for the past months, it's been going way, way down from being at a record high. And I read the Wall Street Journal on Thursday morning, the day after that bounce, and all the traders were saying, look, this was fun to watch the stock market gain 1,000 points, the biggest gain in a single day in a long time. It was fun to watch it, but why? After having gone down and down and down for so long, why did it suddenly go up? And you know what their explanation was? They had no explanation.
There it is.
They said, we're astonished. And then they interviewed the next trader and he said, I'm astonished. It was fun, but we're astonished. In other words, there was no real way for them. And they're there every day. They're the quote experts to even understand to make heads or tails out of why the stock market appeared to go through the roof for a single day. And then the very next day, I don't know how it ended. I can't remember quite, but it started the first half of Thursday. It started with a very, very steep decline once again. In other words, it appears that it was a dead cat bouncing.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent metaphor, really, if we talk about kind of the economy as a whole, especially this last year. What we see is volatility. And so an upward explosion of 1,000 points that's inexplicable and happens in a single day and sets records is not a positive thing. You know, value should have sort of predictability and stability to it. So, I mean, imagine, you know, if the currency that you're using, like if the US dollar is bouncing around like that, where it's suddenly way up and then suddenly way down, causing, you know, the various things you buy throughout the day to wildly fluctuate in price. That would be not a positive. People would not see that as a good thing or as something that they want. And really, that's what we're seeing now. It's overly simplistic to say that when the market goes up, it's good, and when it goes down, it's bad. There needs to be a certain amount of stability. And furthermore, you mentioned, you know, them, the inexplicability of it, right? The traders, these seasoned Wall Street guys that have been doing this for a lot of years, didn't really have an explanation for it. They couldn't explain the sudden increase in value, why all of a sudden are these, you know, basket of stocks valued so much more that it goes up 1,000 points? And when it has no explanation, that shows that it's speculation, that it's not tied to real world events. It's not tied to the fact that some companies had some kind of breakthrough technology or really strong sales or some really amazing cost saving measures that they implemented. It just shows that it's speculation. Enough people with enough money looked at the price that morning and said, you know what, I speculate that it's going to go up. And so they dumped a whole bunch of money in, and that alone was enough to push the price up, which is not to say that it's a real price increase. It's somewhat synthetic and derived by people dumping money in speculation.
That's wisdom right there. The truth of the matter is nobody knows why the stock market goes up and down. I mean, not on a day-to-day basis, nobody knows. I remember seeing on Bloomberg one time, a commentator saying something to the effect that the market was up today on news about real estate or housing construction starts or blah, blah, blah. And then one of the guests said, you know, that's just not true. That's what we tell people every day. But day to day, we don't know why the stock market goes up or down. It's a herd mentality. We can tell you over the course of 6 months or 1 year or 5 years, but we don't know from one day to the next why it goes up or down.
Yeah, absolutely. We look back in time and we try to explain it. And sometimes you can connect it to very real things. You know, the trade war on China, for example, has impacted the stock market significantly. And as announcements are made in the news where they say, this new round of tariffs was imposed in China, and then the stock market tanks the next day, you know, there's a real clear causality. It makes sense. Whereas the 1,000-point jump, there wasn't something that happened the day before that would give you the impression that suddenly things were worth more. And that's the sort of kind of tyranny of the markets that we have, that we're really at the mercy of this sort of wild speculation, which pushes around billions of dollars and impacts hundreds of millions of people's lives.
If we go back to the 2008 Great Recession, right? The financial meltdown on Wall Street. I just went online and did a little research. The thing I was looking for was largest point changes, meaning when did the stock market go up in a single day the most?
Yeah.
And when did it go down in a single day the most? I'm looking at 2008 during that run up to what was the biggest financial crisis, meltdown, depression since 1929, right? The biggest point increase, number two in the history of the stock market, was October 13th, 2008. The stock market went up actually 11 percentage points.
Oh, my God.
That was a smaller market. It was at 9,387. It went up 936 points. That would be about five times as much, I believe, four times as much as what happened last Thursday. Another big day for big stock gains in 2008, October 28th, 2008. And then November 13th, 2008. The stock market went up a 6%, gigantic leaps. And then I'm looking at the largest daily point losses in the same months of October and November on single days. Those are the biggest point losses on the stock market. So Daniel's right.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, stock market went up, good. Stock market went down, bad. The volatility itself is an indicator that the system at that moment or in that time period is, in fact, already in crisis. That's the indicator.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more we can talk about it as well, when there are lots of things that aggravate these sort of instability. So there's a whole market of people that bet against stocks and that basically hedge against them and say stocks are going to go down or stocks are going to go up. And this is a multi-billion-dollar market, possibly trillion, but definitely billion, of derivatives, where people are basically hedging against the stocks and saying, if they go down, I'm going to make money. They're betting against the stocks. And that influx of capital into those derivatives markets actually has the effect of pushing down stocks more. So if big hedge funds, where they have these top traders who supposedly know much more than us and can predict things using very complex mathematical models, are betting against certain stocks, that also causes the market to become nervous about them and pull money out, which causes them to shoot down. So there is this whole kind of feedback loop of traders using derivatives, using computerized trading, algorithmic trading, that really creates this massive herd mentality, which creates that instability. That's what we saw in 2008, right? Was that herd mentality. It wasn't just that the banks engaged in fraud or that they ran out of money. It was that everybody started panicking at the same time in the same way and started pulling back money at the same time. And then normally the banks, which were able to keep themselves afloat, engage in fractional reserve lending and things like that, ran out of money because everybody else started taking it out, pulling it back, wouldn't give out loans, et cetera. And that's what we're kind of seeing sort of the hints at here. So, you know, 2018 has been a time of tremendous political volatility. The Trump administration has rolled back decades-long policies the United States has implemented to try to create stability with global capitalism, with their empire. And this is the end result, is this economic instability that we're seeing now. Who knows what that'll take us into 2019, but I see no reason to think it'll level out or that that stability will somehow return. I think that this is only going to become more aggressive and more aggravated.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel's a financial policy analyst. We're talking about the big economic issues of the past year, 2018. You mentioned, Daniel, that some part of the elite economy spends their money and their time betting against stocks, betting against equities, sometimes betting against currencies, meaning that they're shorting their investment. They're predicting a loss rather than a gain, and they make a lot of money if they're right, if in fact the equity goes down or the stock goes down or the currency goes down. George Soros, by the way, in 1992, George Soros of George Soros fame, broke the Bank of England by shorting the British pound at the time that the British government was trying to intervene in the European exchange rate mechanism, the ERM. He bet against the currency. There was a run on the currency. The currency devalued. Soros was the big winner. Again, for those of us who are lay people, who are not investors, who are not focused on economic issues, how does shorting work? What is it actually?
Yeah, so shorting is an act by which an investor can sort of hedge their bets. So probably everyone's heard of hedge funds, and this is sort of what hedge funds do. That's the hedge in hedge funds. And what you're saying is, look, I'm going to invest in a company, and I think the company's going to go up, and I'm going to make money, right? But nobody knows for sure, right? That's, if anything, we've learned. Even the best, most advanced investors aren't for sure. So what they do is they hedge against their bets. And what that means is they take out loans on those assets based such that if the asset goes badly, they actually make money off of it. It's a way of ensuring that the losses they take on their investment aren't quite as severe. So what you do is you essentially get loaned out stocks, typically, at a higher price, right? At a high price, its current price. And if you think it's going to go down, then, and it does, then you get to sell it back to the person you loaned it to, who loaned it to you, but you sell it back at that lower price. So basically, they get stuck with buying back an asset at a lower price than they originally had, so they lose money on it. And where does that difference go? Where does that money they lost? Well, it goes into your pocket as the person who was hedging their bets. So that's what you're seeing now. It can have incredibly destabilizing effects on the economy, as you mentioned with George Soros destabilizing the Bank of England. I mean, that's kind of insane to think. This person impacted and damaged the lives of millions of people in the United Kingdom, millions of people who don't speculate on currency. They use currency to buy things like, oh, food and houses and fuel.
And it's their savings. So you devalue their savings. They wake up one morning and what they have could be worth 25% less than the day before because somebody else, big investors, billionaires, actually torpedoed the currency in order to make money because they were hedging, because they were betting on the short.
That's exactly right. And think about it. You know, George Soros got rich at the expense of all these everyday people in the United Kingdom, and we're supposed to look up to him like, oh, what a brilliant investor, he's so talented. You know, it's pretty disgusting.
But he gives money to charity now, so we're supposed to be happy about that.
Right, exactly. He steals our money and he gives a percentage of it to people as a way of trying to, I don't know, ingratiate himself to him. And we should be grateful for the fact that he gives us a little bit back of what he took. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's what hedging is. And it's a multi-billion-dollar market, and people make a lot of money off the misery and the loss of value, which impacts working people.
Daniel Sankey, let's go on. We have a number of other big stories for 2018. Where do you want to go next?
I think we should talk really about trade, because I think that's probably been the single biggest story throughout 2018. You know, we can start with the renegotiation of NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, which was signed into law by Bill Clinton, and basically created a trade deal between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It was a bedrock of U.S. globalism. People in very wealthy elites in all three countries made a lot of money on it. But the downstream effects, of course, were that a lot of workers lost their jobs as their jobs were lost to countries who had lower wage labor. So Mexico especially absorbed a lot of very low wage labor, was basically able to do things cheaper than the United States could, and caused a real hollowing out of a lot of sectors of U.S. manufacture, especially automakers. And this was really a talking point for the Trump administration's kind of rise to victory, was that these countries are treating us badly and we have to fight back. And so he renegotiated NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. That had, you know, dramatic effects, sweeping effects. It was really an undoing of global capitalism that had been implemented by that treaty. And really, Wall Street was pretty upset. The noise from the business elites was really universally against what he was doing with NAFTA. And I also want to point out, you know, not to play into Trump's rhetoric that somehow, you know, Mexico was taking advantage of us and their workers were getting rich while workers were getting poor. The truth is NAFTA destroyed many industries in Mexico, the biggest being corn, because it caused really cheap corn produced in the United States to be sold in Mexico with no tariffs, which caused their corn industry to collapse. And so many, many corn farmers went bankrupt and were forced to start growing marijuana and coca for cocaine as a desperate attempt to try to stay alive, because otherwise they would simply starve to death because they couldn't compete. So, you know, lest you think it's workers in Mexico against workers in the United States, it's not. What it really is the global elites in all three countries against the workers in their native countries. And so NAFTA was a big part of Trump renegotiating it and trying to make it more fair for workers. In the end, I think Mexico really caved to a lot of U.S. demands and gave them favorable deals. And Canada stood up more on its own. It had a more developed economy and was able to get more concessions from the U.S. I think it was mostly much ado about nothing, mostly Trump's kind of chest thumping and appealing to his base. But it, you know, that was the point in many ways. Globalization still exists. The supply chains between the three countries still exist, and they're still very significant and powerful. And so I think that they're here to stay in many ways. But that was a major story, and it showed a major reorientation of United States foreign policy and power.
Indeed. And we've mentioned this before. I lived in New York City in 1994, January 1st, when NAFTA took effect. I think there were no Mexicans living in New York City at that time. Within a decade, there were probably 100,000 Mexicans living in New York City. I had the opportunity to go to Chiapas, the southern state in Mexico, when the treaty was signed, because the Zapatistas carried out an armed uprising under the slogan that NAFTA would be a death sentence for indigenous people in Chiapas because they were corn growers. And indeed it was. So you had American corn growers who are big agribusiness companies that can produce corn more cheaply than a small peasant farmer on a small piece of land because they're using industrial farming methods. They could then sell the corn in Mexico because of NAFTA. They could sell the corn at a cheaper price. Mexicans stopped buying Mexican corn. They started buying American corn. The corn growers went out of business. There was no more Mexican, sort of the agricultural sector was destroyed. And then the American agribusiness companies raised the price of corn. So now people had no income because they could no longer be corn growers and they couldn't afford corn. And they, you know, their diet was corn. I mean, the people in southern Mexico ate corn. If you are what you eat, the people in southern Mexico were corn people. I mean, that was the basic staple of their diet. But now they couldn't buy corn and they couldn't grow corn. And so they moved or they started growing marijuana or coca. And so we have all of these unintended consequences, the war on drugs, mass migration of Mexicans and others to New York City and other places. And as again, working people are not determining these policies. They're not driving these policies. They are, in fact, the victims of these policies and they're policies that they have no say over.
And that's a really important point, is that they don't have a say over these policies. And in a lot of ways, Trump's victory was tied to the fact that he was trying to give a voice to these voiceless Americans. Now, I think it was purely opportunistic, and I don't think he really cares at all about working people, but I do think he cares about appealing to them as a way of gaining power, which is, I think, a big part of what he does. But I think it appealed to a lot of working people, because I'll tell you, on the Democrat and mainstream Republican side, you weren't hearing any anti-trade rhetoric. If you asked them across both sides of the aisle, NAFTA was a good thing. It was good for workers. It was the right move. And we should, you know, have more NAFTA-like agreements. So that's really an important part of why his message appealed to a lot of many, many millions of Americans who have watched their livelihood slowly vanish as it goes overseas, who are watching their kids with less opportunities than they had and enjoyed. And I think that was a big part of the appeal of Trump's effect is, you know, as disgusting a racist and as sexist as he is, they saw someone that was willing to at least say, hey, these trade deals are hurting people, even if it was opportunistic. And you know, if we could shift gears a little bit.
Yeah, let's turn to China.
Yeah, let's turn to China. So China's a big story as well in terms of the tariff war, which is now going on between the United States and China. The United States has now determined that China is its big enemy. And you're really seeing kind of it line up on both sides of the aisle. You're really seeing a shift in foreign policy that we've decided that China is going to be our next big major power confrontation. And Trump has really led the charge on that. And it's really kind of amazing how we've seen the shift in the global elites to sort of buying into that and saying, okay, we'll give you your war against China. We think you got a point there. So what we've seen is a tariff war, which is an active war. I mean, it's not dropping a bomb or anything, but it impacts millions of lives and it impacts the economy, which is a very significant thing to do. What it has caused is China to retaliate in kind and impose tariffs on the United States. What's is exposed is the global economic connection between the United States and China, that it's not really just this weak vassal power that's at the beck and call of the United States, that it does have its own economy, its own citizenry, and its own ability to fight back and punch back a lot, which it is. It's targeted a lot of U.S. sectors that are traditionally pro-Trump as a way of kind of punishing certain wealthy, you know, billionaires in those sectors for their support of this administration. And really, you're seeing a growing conflict between the Trump administration and China. It's frightening. China is very well equipped militaristically. China has more than 1 billion people in its population. China is a major world power. And if there was to be some kind of real confrontation between the United States and China, many millions of people would die on both sides. These tariff wars are a start of that. They're frightening, and we can't overestimate their significance. We don't want to sort of downplay it and say, oh, it's just an economic thing. It's a significant shift. For most of the time, China's relationship with the United States, at least since the 70s, when it opened up to U.S. commerce, was positive. And United States business really saw China as an ally, an opportunity to profit, a source of cheap labor. And really, you're seeing that major shift now to where China is now becoming the enemy and becoming put in our crosshairs.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joins us every Tuesday on Loud and Clear to talk about the big economic issues of the week. Now we're talking about the economic issues of the year. Time is going fast. We have about 5 minutes left. Daniel, I know you are about to finish up, and then I want to ask you about the media report that came out towards the end of last week, where President Trump seems to be weighing an executive order to be signed as early as January to declare a national emergency and ban U.S. companies from using any telecommunications equipment made by Chinese companies Huawei or ZTE. That's according to media reports at the end of last week. Go ahead.
That's extremely significant because that just goes along with the escalation that we've seen. Initially, we had some tariffs going into effect. And then we had China responding in kind with more tariffs and them trying to bring the U.S. to the table to discuss how they might roll back these tariffs, how they might get on a more peaceful ground. And now we have what effectively is a economic embargo, a sanction against these two companies, which are some of the largest in China and frankly, some of the largest in the world. Huawei produces the majority of the hardware that powers the internet. They produce the second most amount of smartphones of any company. They're a huge global player. And for Trump to take aim at these shows that the United States is not going to diplomatically resolve its situation with China. It is not going to resolve it in a way anything less than China's total capitulation to U.S. demands, which China cannot do, will not do. It would devastate its economy. It would devastate its country. That's the point. The United States is trying to force China to do things it cannot do so that it can use that as a pretext for further aggression, for further militarism. This is a formula that's employed against a lot of other countries in the past, unfortunately, to devastating effects. So this is a continuing escalation. This administration has shown no real interest in kind of real politics, in what's possible and what can be done, in allowing itself to save face or allowing other countries to let it save face. It has shown full and all-out aggression. And some of the most rabid anti-Chinese foreign policy people in the world.
Daniel, we have 3 minutes left. Real quick, there was the bankruptcy of Sears. Younger people might not understand what that means.
And just last week, JCPenney fell to under $1 a share for the first time in its history.
And then you have General Motors and Ford announcing that they're closing, not opening factories, slashing tens of thousands of jobs here in the United States. I mean, Trump might say it's bringing manufacturing back to the United States, but these companies who are the deciders on these questions, it doesn't look like it. Go ahead. We're losing a lot of jobs right now.
We are losing a tremendous amount of jobs, and that's in part why we see such volatility in the stock markets. You know, for younger listeners to understand, JCPenney, Sears, Ford, General Motors, these are kind of bedrock companies in the United States that really have almost been synonymous with the United States for a long time. And what it's showing is that these giants are falling apart, and they're cutting jobs because they're entering new phases of manufacture where not as many people are needed to manufacture things. Or like Sears and JCPenney, they're going bankrupt as online companies really steal their markets, companies like Amazon. Why go to Sears, wait in a long line with exhausted, underpaid staff people when you can just buy it online and it'll be shipped to your house shortly, or maybe dropped by drone in some areas. So that's what we're seeing now. And what we're seeing is really the automation of these industries. They're not going away so much. There's still a demand for cars. There's still a demand for goods and services that Sears offers. But what we're seeing is an automation of workers and all these workers' jobs being cut as these companies turn into these centralized, automated online things. The end result is more and more immiseration of the working class, more and more loss of jobs and loss of livelihood for these people as these very wealthy elites convert and automate a huge portion of their workforce. And that's really the trend we're seeing now. And that's why we see part of why we see so much volatility in the market.
We have 60 seconds left. Daniel Sankey, what's 2019 going to look like?
I think 2019 will see a continuing movement in these directions. We'll continue to see a worsening of the relationship between the Trump administration and China, unless there's some kind of real grassroots opposition to war between these countries. And we'll see a continuing automation of working people as these companies move towards the automated system. Unless, of course, people stand up and start demanding real jobs and real income and real pay for the work that they do. And that's really the wild card. If people are willing to organize, if there is willing to be a real progressive grassroots resistance against these things, where people stand up and confront corporations, where people stand up and confront this administration, then we're going to see some major changes in the other direction. But if we don't, if that doesn't happen, if people continue to sort of accept and allow this to be business as usual, then we will continue to see an increase in militarism, a degeneration of foreign relations, and also a more unstable economy where the rich get even richer than already and the poor continue to get still poorer.
We're going to leave it right there. Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst, has joined us every week here at Loud and Clear to talk about the big economic issues of that week. And this time we talked about the big economic issues of the year. Daniel Sankey, I know our audience, our listeners really appreciate your coming on Loud and Clear every week. The economy is a big issue. Sadly, there's nobody that's really breaking it down in terms that lay people, that would be we the people, understand as well as you do every week. So we want to just express to you our gratitude and to wish you a very, very, very happy new year. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. 2018 is coming to an end, and we're looking at the year in review in our regular segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Today, we look at changes and developments in the world of technology over the past year. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, good to have you.
Always great to be back on, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year. Chris, you know, when we look back over this past year, there's one underlying theme that took us really from January to December, and that is Facebook, Facebook, Facebook. Let's start with that.
Yeah, it's true. We've seen Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg up on, first in their war rooms and then in front of Congress. And we've seen, it seems like every other day there's a new Facebook story, right? So let's go back all the way to January. If you can, believe it. It was almost a year ago. Facebook had this new public relations campaign where they were saying, we're going to put more of what you want to see on your newsfeed. And of course, they were doing this because of 2017's major Facebook stories, particularly, this criticism around elections and all of that. They said in January of this year, they said that they were going to be putting up more stories from your friends and your family and the things you wanted to see. But what that did, it actually attacked us, smaller pages, basically removed the reach of Facebook pages. So if you follow news sites, if you follow a band or whatnot, they basically had to pay more in order to get onto your newsfeed. But that was how Facebook started. They started the year, they wanted to say, hey, we're doing things to benefit you. They kind of came out on the offensive almost. And then the Cambridge Analytica scandal hit. Seems, again, hard to believe that was this year. That was, many months ago.
Seems like forever ago.
It seems like forever ago for sure. But we found out that Facebook had partnered with this company, Cambridge Analytica, had partnered with a researcher who had partnered with this company. And they basically got all of this information about us and our friends and our interests on Facebook that they really shouldn't have had. And there was, front page stories for days and days and days. There were congressional hearings, all sorts of criticism of Facebook, but nothing really ever came of it except a couple apologies by Mark Zuckerberg and a couple long Facebook posts. Well, you'd think they would have learned their lesson, right? After Cambridge Analytica. But then we get into some stories where we learn about what they were doing in years past. They had never admitted to us. Now, this is after Facebook had, and particularly Zuckerberg as their public face, had committed to being transparent and open with the public, in front of Congress and in these blog posts. But then we find out that a few years ago, Facebook made exclusive partnerships with over 55 device manufacturers, including Apple and Google and others like Samsung, to give information about you to these device manufacturers, even if you weren't necessarily using the Facebook app. There was a data sharing partnership going on. This is just really getting us to June, John.
Boy, oh boy. And the funny thing too is, Sheryl Sandberg, when her book Lean In came out, it came out right around the time that her husband died of cancer. He was very young. And there was great sympathy in the press for her, and the book was wildly popular. It shot up to number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. She was seen as sort of the golden child of corporate CEOs. And there was actually talk of Sheryl Sandberg running for president. And the damage to her reputation just in the past 6 months because of her seeming inability to protect our personal data and our information as CEO of Facebook has done what I think is irreparable damage.
I would agree. And I think this is actually, an important time to point out the sexism in the tech industry and in the media overall, though, because there's still talk of a Zuckerberg 2020 campaign.
Oh, boy. Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg 2020. I wonder who he would get to run with him. I'm kind of terrified to know. Maybe, Larry Page or Sergey Brin or somebody. But
that's right.
But I think we need to point out, yes, there has been a very legitimate criticism of Sheryl Sandberg, a very real criticism. And that did, if she had any of those sorts of, intentions to run, it did completely crash that. But it should have also crashed Zuckerberg's as well. I certainly wouldn't vote for either of them. And hopefully people don't have to make that choice. But, we saw what happened in 2016. And if we can get a reality star as president, who knows who else is going to get in the race.
Tell us a little bit also about what Facebook did over the past year with regard to device manufacturers, app makers. What did they do to sort of try to enhance the value of Facebook while selling out our own personal information?
Well, Facebook, as we saw recently from a document that was released by a British MP, a member of parliament, regarding a lawsuit, Facebook is all about growth. And growth means profit. And profit for Facebook means targeting more advertising and collecting more data to sell more advertising, right? Facebook made partnerships, like I said earlier, with these device manufacturers. But then, a few years ago when they had already been under some criticism, they said, we're going to tone down what applications can get from you on Facebook. But it turns out they did that for some applications, for and really for most applications. But for the biggest ones and the ones that requested extensions and requested special permissions, they were more than happy to give that out. So they gave, for example, Netflix and I believe it was HSBC Bank permission to read and write Facebook and delete Facebook messages. So they could read your Facebook messages, right? They gave them permission to see who your friends were and some and a little bit of information about your friends when many apps couldn't get those permissions. So they were partnering with the largest companies. And these were tech companies, these were advertising companies, these are companies all over the spectrum that they were giving these special permissions to, while saying to the rest of the world, and I've worked with Facebook's integration for my clients with my work, saying to the rest of the world, hey, we're cutting back because people don't want your, you know, people don't want you to have their information. And it's very true. People don't want Facebook or, you know, random app developers to have their information. And it makes absolute sense, right? Something else we found out this year about Facebook is just to the extent that they're storing information on you. They had a data breach, or they've had many data breaches this year. And we found out that, among other things, when you upload an image to Facebook, even if you don't post it, they save that image.
They save the image.
They save the image, even if you don't post it. So it's been one scandal after another. It got to the point where the founder of WhatsApp, which is, you know, used to be an independent messaging, you know, application, like, you know, like text messaging or Signal, Jan Koum is one of the founders and left, but also the other co-founder, Brian Acton, actually says it's time to delete Facebook. You know, they got out after making, you know, many, many millions of dollars, of course. But they left in a very especially Brian Acton left in a very public way in early 2018, saying that he had sold out his user's privacy to Facebook and that he was leaving because they want Facebook leadership wanted WhatsApp to decrease the security in their messages so that Facebook could use the content of your messages to target advertising.
I don't even know what to say in response to that.
Now, WhatsApp, it's not widely used, I guess, in the United States. I had first heard of it from some family in Europe.
Yeah, it's wildly popular in Europe and in Brazil. It's, I mean, everybody in Brazil uses WhatsApp.
It's gotten more popular in the U.S., but it's and it used to be a great app. It used to be secure. It was fantastic, but it's not that secure anymore.
See, and this is in addition to the rumors, and I think there's probably something to these rumors, that NSA has a backdoor into WhatsApp. That's why I quit using WhatsApp and I went with Viber, which is a European-based encrypted chat app. But you know, if you've got NSA mucking around in there, and then Facebook loosening security so they can read your messages to target advertising at you, that's not a secure chat app at all.
What do you use, John?
Viber, V-I-B-E-R.
And that's more secure.
It's more secure. Viber and Signal, I think, are better. I mean, nothing's perfect, as Chris will tell us, but I think Viber is better than WhatsApp.
Is it secure? I mean, are any of these secure? And follow-up question, is it secure? Let's say you're not a target of the NSA or the CIA. You're just a person, so you're having encrypted conversations on Signal or Viber. Is that secure? And then if you are sort of a target, let's say the CIA has control of your phone.
Yeah.
You know, through some other means.
They'll intercept the message as you're typing it before it's encrypted.
Right.
So it's not secure in that respect. If you're a target, they're going to get your comms. And there's almost nothing you can do to protect yourself.
Go ahead.
That's right. If the CIA has actually gotten access to your phone, the NSA, whoever, if they've gotten access to your phone, especially physical access, all bets are off and you should throw it out the window at 90 miles an hour for if they have physical access. You know, in terms of if you might be a target of surveillance, the best thing to do is not type anything at all. The second best would be to use Signal and use its disappearing messages feature so that things aren't stored on your phone if somebody should get access to it. For most people, you know, I still recommend Signal. I recommend Signal to all my friends who I text with and, you know, just trying to get them to install it, because the more people use it, the less we have to worry. So yes, you can use WhatsApp and have general privacy and security if you're not concerned about, you know, a state agent getting into your messages. But then you still have to be worried about the fact that Facebook is using that information to build a profile on you and target advertising to you.
Yeah, I think it's scandalous. Chris, you made this point months ago, too, and I think it bears repeating. Facebook doesn't provide these services out of the goodness of its heart. It does it because it's trying to make money from us. And nobody reads those terms of service agreements that we all agree to. We probably should. And I think if we did, we probably wouldn't be using things like Facebook.
You know, we might not be. I sometimes do read the terms of service to know what exactly is going on. And even when you do, they are in legalese and they're very vague. They'll say that we might share data with our partners, but they don't say most of the time who those partners are.
Yeah, who the partners are.
Right. Or who the partners are going to share it with. So there could be, you know, 5-10 layers deep of data sharing going on with companies you've never even heard of. And you don't know anything about their security, their practices, who they're owned by, what they're sharing with other companies. You don't know. And that's a lot of what we've been finding out from Facebook this year. And it certainly extends to other social networks. It extends to other just websites that we use.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Chris Garaffa, technologist. We talk to Chris every Monday about the big technology issues of the week. But now, because it's December 31st, we're talking about the biggest technology issues of 2018. Let's keep going, Chris. Let's talk about, again, we're still talking about Facebook, but let's talk about censorship.
Yeah, this was a big year in censorship for Facebook and, you know, many other social networks, right? YouTube, Twitter, and others, but particularly Facebook, where Facebook went and they started taking down pages and profiles of people who may have, you know, who they accused of being, let's say, Russian trolls or, you know, attempting to somehow interfere in elections with a few hundred or a couple thousand dollars of ads. But they also went after primarily left-wing or progressive or alternative news sources. They took down particularly a page called Venezuela Analysis, which is a fantastic news source to see what's going on in Venezuela that is not going to just parrot the line of, you know, CNN or MSNBC or, you know, the U.S. State Department, and is actually, you know, tells the truth about the situation in Venezuela and what's going on there. That was one of the biggest takedowns. And because of all the public pressure that came up, they did reinstate that page. But there were many other takedowns that happened on Facebook and on Twitter. And they say it was, it's political interference, it's all these other things, but really it's targeting of primarily alternative news sources. There were pages dedicated to documenting police brutality as well that were caught up in this.
Chris, I know that on August 12th of this year, which was the one-year anniversary of the Unite the Right so-called rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that rally where anti-racist demonstrators were violently attacked, Heather Heyer was run over and killed by a car. Many, many more people were injured. The Unite the Right was planning to come back to Washington, D.C. In fact, they did come back on August 12th, 1 year later. And I, as an organizer with the Answer Coalition, helped organize a counter-protest. We had about 15,000 people in Lafayette Park. But I have to tell you, in terms of the run-up to that demonstration, there was a lot of fear, a lot of, like, if you turned on the local TV here, you just see a video loop of that car running into Heather Heyer and the other anti-racist activists the year before, killing her and hurting so many, or other scenes where pro-Nazi or Nazi or pro-Klan or Klan people were, you know, had automatic weapons pointing at people that year before in Charlottesville. A lot of fear. So Answer Coalition that I work with, we got permits to come to Lafayette Park, and we told everybody, come to Lafayette Park where these right-wing fascists are going to be coming, and we can overwhelm them not by the employment of violence, but by the employment of numbers, large numbers of people. Now, there were a lot of groups organizing and a lot of individuals organizing because people were mortified that there was going to be a celebration on this anniversary. And so people were doing that. Now, one of the organizers in Washington had set up a Facebook page called whatever it was, something against the Nazis and against the Klan, urging people to come out to show opposition to these fascists. And Facebook shut that page down. And a lot of people had signed up or were following it. They shut it down because They said it was inauthentic behavior. So how is it that Facebook or these people, we don't know who they are, how do they determine when an anti-fascist protest is inauthentic? At the very moment that we're trying to promote the message, look, it's good to organize, it's good to mobilize, there's safety in numbers, let's come out. And then you have Facebook. You have Mark Zuckerberg deciding, oh, I consider this inauthentic behavior, and shutting the page down the week before the demonstration, obviously something that would be considered very helpful to the right wing.
You know, I do remember that that page, I believe it's something like Stop the Unite the Right 2 rally. And I do remember that demonstration. I thought it was so important. I came down from Connecticut to D.C. for that, to stand up. And if it were just Mark Zuckerberg sitting there determining what, you know, what's good and what's not, that would be one thing. But Facebook has all of these shadowy partners that it uses to do so-called fact-checking. One of these major partners is the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is really a NATO think tank. The Atlantic Council is made up of neoconservative and some neoliberal elements, and they are a NATO think tank. They back up whatever it is that NATO and particularly the U.S. leadership are saying. So whatever's convenient for the basically Western imperial attitudes is going to be part of what Facebook is guided to do in their censorship. They have other, Google has partnerships with other right-wing publications as well to do this so-called fact-checking on its news site. So as much as it would be convenient for it to be, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, and I know that's not what you were saying, but as people, you know, maybe thinking that, you know, somebody sitting in an office somewhere, it's more of this kind of shadowy group of various fact-checkers, mostly on the right wing, all in defense of the existing system, who are doing things like saying, let's shut down this Unite the Right 2 page, or the Stop the Unite the Right 2 page, but allow Unite the Right 2 to go on and promote its ideology.
Right. I mean, when you look at the Atlantic Council, and I'm glad we brought this up, because this is one of the big stories of 2018. Facebook is censoring people who are mainly on the left. I mean, the right is always crying about how Facebook is like slanted against the right. Maybe they are too, I don't know. But I know they're slanted against the left. They've been censoring pages that have pro-Palestinian rights content or a content that's supportive of BDS, boycott, divest, sanctions. But in order to do this so that it doesn't look like it's just Facebook functioning as a censor, they pick these partnering groups that they say, this partnering group, I think Atlantic Council has some digital something-something sort of subdivision or task force. And they then become the entity that recommends who should stay on Facebook and who should be censored, as if they were independent, as if they were benign, as if they were neutral. And then you look at who the donors are to the Atlantic Council. I mean, you have the United Arab Emirates. They're in the 1 million plus donations. I mean, the United Arab Emirates is it's a dictatorship. You have United Airlines. You have Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, the Airbus Group. Chevron, General Atomics, HSBC Holdings, United Technologies Corporation is one of the biggest war contractors in the United States. NATO itself is a donor. The Rockefeller, the Blackstone Group. I mean, when you go down through this list, there's nothing about this that would indicate independence or the ability of this group to function as a neutral sort of judge, jury, and executioner about whose Facebook pages are authentic and which ones are inauthentic. And yet it's a tool by Facebook to do the dirty work.
That's right. And, you know, it's the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. And, you know, I just want to read from their website. They've operationalized the study of disinformation by exposing falsehoods and fake news, documenting human rights abuses, and building digital resilience. But if you look at their coverage, it falls directly in line with the U.S. government, with the State Department, with the oil companies and their interests. It never talks about the real human rights abuses happening in the United States or by the United States.
Yeah, one of the donors for the Atlantic Council, everybody, is ExxonMobil. Talking about inauthentic behavior, I mean, Exxon researchers were the sort of the leading lights in many ways to discover the or to examine, explore, and validate the idea of global warming 40 years ago. and how this was the consequence of human activity, and in particular, the production of oil and gas. Exxon knew it was real, and then Exxon, for the next 40 years, paid for climate change deniers to issue documents, to have conferences, to be quoted in the mass media. In other words, they knew it was true and then created a whole propaganda apparatus to convince the people and society that climate change wasn't happening. That's Exxon, right now ExxonMobil. So they're now a donor to the Atlantic Council, this neoconservative think tank here in Washington, right around the corner from us. And this group then says what Facebook pages are authentic and which are inauthentic, and they're shutting down as inauthentic organizations that were organizing around and against the Unite the Right to rally, this fascist celebration of what I consider to be a celebration of racist violence. Yeah, when you go through these kind of techniques, you can't but come to the conclusion that Facebook is doing nothing other than trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the public. They're censoring that which the U.S. government or the powers that be find to be objectionable. They're trying to say we're fair and we're impartial because we have third-party players that are helping us make these judgment calls. But those third parties like Atlantic Council themselves, funded by NATO and Exxon and General Electric and United Technologies.
That's right.
I mean, when you really get down to it, it's pretty astonishing. Let's keep going. Chris Garaffa, the year in review with technology stories. Data breaches.
Well, we had data breaches from, of course, Facebook, but also Google, which said that it was going to shut down its Google Plus service and then move that deadline up because of not one but two data breaches that apparently no one at Google noticed until months later, partly because they just didn't care about that product. They weren't paying attention to it, and they were planning on what they called sunsetting it, letting it die. We recently had the Marriott breach. We got the report on the Equifax breach that happened last year, just this month. And just last night, it turns out, online beverage distributor, and they have retail stores as well. They sell liquor and wine online. BevMo said that they had their client credit card information stolen as well. It has been a year of massive data breaches, and it's almost the new normal. And it is in many cases criminal how our data is not secured, because it's just going to cost a little extra money to take the right steps to protect our data. And of course, these companies, just like with every other risk that they take, they weigh the profit versus the cost and say if it's going to be more profitable to, you know, pay for credit monitoring service or pay a tiny little fine, then they say, you know, it's not worth the cost to install or hire a security expert or install some software update. It's criminal, really.
Let's keep going. Let's go fast now. We have 5 minutes left. The Bloomberg China story. Go ahead.
We just want to keep this, you know, in people's minds. Bloomberg had that giant story front page. It was in the headlines for days that the Chinese government, the People's Liberation Army, was installing these little, you know, microchips on motherboards that were going into U.S. bound servers to spy on us. Everyone from Apple to Supermicro to literally, I mean, the Department of Homeland Security even said, no, this is, there's no proof of this. It's not true. Bloomberg to this day still has yet to issue any sort of real retraction or comment on the story, but it certainly did its part to heighten the anti-China mood in the U.S.
All right. Current state of privacy law. Go ahead.
Two important things from this year, a couple court decisions. The Supreme Court ruled earlier, I believe it was in April, that the government does need to get a warrant if they want to get your cell phone location data from your cell phone provider. Remember, your cell phone is always tracking where you are. And that's actually a basic thing about how cell phones work. It has to know what tower to ping off of to get you your service. But the Supreme Court ruled that, yeah, they do. The police and law enforcement need to get a warrant to get that data. The other thing is that we reaffirmed this year that the police or law enforcement or Customs and Border Patrol cannot force you to give your password to unlock your device, but they can force you to give your fingerprint to unlock your device.
Which I still can't get over, I have to say. I remember we talked about this a couple of months ago, and we talked about this in the context of the cops going to the morgue to try to take the fingerprint of a man that they had shot to death, to try to get his fingerprint to open the phone. It didn't succeed. They had no warrant. His family jumped up and down in the media. And our conversation was about how it's just so, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I don't even know how to say it there. It just doesn't make any logical sense at all for the police to not be allowed to ask you for your password without a warrant, but they can force you to provide a thumbprint. Makes no sense at all.
Let's keep moving. Protests of tech workers, big story from 2018.
Yes, it was, you know, among the first times we've seen tech workers organizing from Salesforce and Google and Amazon and Facebook. You know, we saw massive Google walkouts at two-thirds of their global locations in protest of sexual harassment, you know, in their leadership of this partnership with the Department of Defense and Project Maven, which they successfully targeted. They successfully canceled that project. It's been an amazing year for activism and organizing in the tech industry, which has traditionally not been a place of major organizing. And this is a trend I want to continue in the next year.
Okay, real quick, we have 2 minutes left. In the next minute, make your predictions, and then we're going to do the tech tip.
All right. Well, we're going to see more Facebook scandals for sure. That we are not done with Facebook, but I think we're also going to see some more focus on Twitter and Snap and other social networks, because we always say it's not just Facebook. Facebook is the biggest, but it's not just Facebook. I think we're going to see some increased hostility in the digital realm with Iran, China, Russia, and possibly Venezuela, all countries that are being targeted by the U.S. government. And just as, you know, there are military and economic sanctions against them, I think they're going to use, you know, threats of hacking as a weapon against them. I think we're going to see more huge fallout from data breaches, just as 2018 was a huge year for that. We're going to see more in 2019. And you know, unfortunately, I think we're going to see nothing of substance from lawmakers and Congress, and certainly not the White House, in terms of protecting our rights and protecting our data. That's going to be the continuing trend.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We're talking to him tonight on New Year's Eve. Next week, we'll talk to him in the year 2019. But Chris Garaffa, do as you do every week with us. You give us a tech tip. What is it this week?
You know, really quickly, the tech tip is actually a little less about tech, but how we respond and how we are going to close out the year. And it's this: don't panic and don't feel helpless. We talk about the breaches of our personal information, the violations of our Fourth Amendment rights. We do this every week, and we always have a new story about Facebook violating our trust. But technology has the capacity also to help us build a new society of justice and freedom and equality. And it's not the tool itself that causes these ills, but whose hands it's in. So whether it's used for profit and oppression, then we're profiled and searched and censored. But imagine if we could use technology, for example, drones, to fight wildfires instead of policing black neighborhoods, or if we could use social media for education instead of advertising, and if we could keep up with people across the world without the fear of being spied on. Technology itself isn't going to bring that about. But I don't want people to feel helpless, because we have an opportunity, and I think we have a responsibility to ourselves and others, to keep building the movements for justice and the real change that will at least in part use technology to build a better world for all of us. So that's my tech tip. Don't feel helpless.
Okay. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, we'll see you again in the new year. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.